If there's one clear image of God in the Bible, it's King. And you go to a place like Psalms 115 or Psalms 135, and you find that he's not any kind of ordinary king. He is a sovereign king over all of creation, and he has a kingdom that is advancing. And you also find out this, that he's not a constitutional monarch. He is a sovereign, ruling, reigning king. And it says in the Psalms, he does and can do whatever he pleases. Which means he has a grand plan as monarch and king. We've kind of studied this over the last semester in the winter months and into the spring, and we saw that God has this wonderful kingdom plan for the world, and this is to show us this amazing drama from time to the end of time as we know it, where he unfolds and displays in variously marvelous degrees his majesty and his glory, and he does it by rescuing wayward worshipers so that they get to take part in, at least on his side in this drama, though everyone who's not on his side really are in this drama too. And so we can say that he has this amazing plan to display his glory marvelously. For those who he rescues, and the truth is, for those who are not rescued as well, they will be displays of his glory too. And then we come to a little book like Ezra. And then Nehemiah, just a little bit longer, and then even shorter, Esther. Esther's kind of unusual because it doesn't even mention the word God, but it certainly includes the king. And over the next few months, as we roll up into the Christmas season, we're going to look at each of these three little books. And they're going to come in a time that you may or may not be familiar with, but it's going to look like there's all kinds of oppositions. The truth is, anytime you or I or we form a plan, opposition always comes about, right? I don't know if you've ever done any kind of building around your home. There's always opposition to your building projects. It could be your lack of ability, or my lack of ability, not yours. It could be time. You might be under a time oppositional restraint. It could be that you get in to what you think is going to be an easy job, and it is way deeper and worse than you thought. Or it may be that you just don't have the funds to finish it, so you start it. And it keeps going and going and going. There was a house where we used to live in Maryland, and they were building it as they got the funds, and so they put up a few rows of bricks, and it stayed there for a few months. And then they put a few more bricks, and it stayed there for a few more months. And that's how they just work on their home. In the Old Testament, God has a plan and a piece to this drama that really isn't unlike where we fall into the drama. And it's basically this, is that God has elected a people, namely Israel, his people, through whom he's going to raise up an offspring to crush the curse so that he might make a way for those wayward worshipers to be redeemed and brought back and to be objects on display for the glory of God. Now, if you know the story of Ezra, they're on the tail end of what looked like the end of a dream. They've been in exile for 70 years. They were really not sure where do we have a place as God's people any longer. Who are we? They were only a people of God because he elected them, they were a nation. They rebelled and called for their own king and dispatched God for an earthly king. And then he dropped into this point of exile. And now when we get to Ezra, we're going to be on the other side of the exile, the other side of the 70 years, and something's going to happen to give not only them, but I think also us, great hope today. And it's this, that God keeps his promises, and he is sovereign, and he reigns, and his plan and his purposes will prevail. God keeps his promises. He is sovereign and he reigns, and his plans and his purposes will prevail. Always. And that's where I want to pick up into this story. And as we're as you turn there to Ezra, I don't know how you deal with opposition when it comes, but I think of a guy like David Livingston. He was missionary to Africa, missionary, pioneer missionary to Africa. This guy was a phenomenal guy. He was persevered in the work that God had called him to do. He walked over 29,000 miles in his ministry. You would keep going after the fifth mile of these riches, but he went 29,000 miles. The amazing thing about him is that he was nearly completely blind as he went. And yet, he was trudging through the jungle and different places in Africa. His wife died early in his ministry, and yet he stayed at it. He didn't give up. He didn't give in. And ironically, sometimes opposition comes from really weird places. You would have thought that the one spot where we get the most support and encouragement and propping up would be his own brethren, but yet it was the church and his people in Scotland who were probably the strongest opponents to his ministry. What do you do in the midst of opposition? When you know God has his plan, he's got you in a direct path, how do you keep going with it? And I want to suggest to you this morning that the only way for us as God's people and his church to keep going and keep moving forward is to realize this, is that God reigns, he keeps his promises, he is sovereign, and his plans and his purposes will prevail. And that's what we're going to see over and over and over as we look at Ezra, and then Esther, really, and then Nehemiah is the word of the days. Let's follow along. Let's jump into the very first part of the story and see what's happening. I just want to walk through. We're just going to look at a few verses today just to kind of get our feet into this great, amazing, wonderful book. Then I'll give you 3 points to really give us a boldness about God's promises and the fact that he keeps his promises and what that tells us. So listen to what it says. It says this: in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. So this is basically putting us somewhere around 539 to 538 BC. This is 70 years at the end of the exile. This is 490 plus 70 years at the end of the nation of Israel. And so this is putting us roughly 600-ish years before the coming of Jesus. But the interesting thing here is the fact that we step into this picture with no reference about Israel. The first reference for us is this pagan king who has supplanted Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylons and has now the Medes and the Persians are on the scene. And notice what it says next, because we don't want to be too detached from this bigger drama that God is doing in the world, and he's still doing things today. Notice it says, in the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. This goes back to Jeremiah chapter 25. In fact, in many ways, Jeremiah 25 tells us that, well, 70 years you're going to be in exile. Here's why. 490 years as a nation, you've been in this land that I gave to you. You didn't just take it, I gave it to you. And every 7th year the land was supposed to rest and you didn't let it rest. So if you 490 divided by 7, I remember we had a math major in the house and some math teachers. But My guess is that adds up to 70 years. God keeps his word and is serious about his word. Every seventh year, the land is supposed to rest, and so because they didn't allow the land to rest, he said, you will be in exile, and the exile will be when we look 7 years. But there's other words from Jeremiah that we fulfilled too. You see, this is really, I'm going to be careful here, because if you go to a search engine like Bible Gateway, or if you were to Google the number one search American verse, I don't know if you know what it provides. It's not John 3:16, although that's a great verse. The number one verse that will pop up will be Jeremiah 29:11. I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Now, in Jeremiah 29:11, he's really not talking about you, he's not talking about America. Might better say that again, just so that you get it. He's not really talking about us, and he's not talking about America prospering and being great, and Trump is here and made America great again. That's not what he's talking about. In fact, what he's talking about in Jeremiah 29:11 is this, Ezra chapter 1, verse 1, in the first year of the year of King Cyrus, the king of Persia, so that the word of the Lord might be fulfilled through the prophet Jeremiah, the exile is now come to an end. I'm bringing you back to my land for my glory. You see, for 70 years, they were told, go into the land, seek the welfare of the city, stay there, but listen, though I know you're coming in, I know the very few people, you've got to see the front end, the tail end, and the annual about how to run with you. You've got to see all of these things unfold. But yet, here they were now, on the other side of God's hand. I know some people can't see it, because they have passed away in hour. But now for you, the remnant who are remaining and left, my word is being fulfilled because I keep my promises. And the promise that I gave to Jeremiah, to you, through Jeremiah, to you, is now coming to full bloom. And so my word will live. God keeps his word. Always. He's sovereign. His plans and his purposes will prevail. Now, notice what it says next. Works. In this moment, in order to fulfill the word that God gave to Jeremiah, notice what it says next. He, the Lord, stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, I don't know what that was like and what that looked like, but I think the divine Joel was utterly astounding to God's people. He's taking this pagan king who has no claim to God, and he's doing something for his glory through somebody that you would not normally think he would use. I mean, why not raise up another great prophet? Why not raise up some rebels who would overtake all of the means of the Persians? Why not, you know, just bring Israel to be the superpower? Because that's not the way God works. See, God rarely works according to our logic, right? And he raises up this pagan king and he stirs his heart. The word there for stir is kind of like arousing. I don't know about you, but I go in to stir up my kids in the morning. And in fact, actually, to stir up the living, I've got to peel back all of the layers of covers that she's got over her head. Because she doesn't, I mean, she gets down and she burrows in like a little bowl, and she's all covered up, and she will get into the world. And in fact, she won't get up to return her family, because that's I'm turned down, I'm not going to get out of bed there. But that's the picture there. It's like, awaken. It is stirred up. It kind of think like when the coals are hot, but they're not inflamed, and you blow on them, and it drops from the flame. That's the idea here of arousing or stirring. God has come to this pagan king as sovereign king, even over Cyrus, and he has stirred him so that, notice what it says, that he would make a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put the proclamation right. Now this is going to be important because this proclamation is going to stand prominent here at the beginning and prominent at the end of chapter 7, which is roughly about 80 years later, long after Cyrus is gone. But this proclamation is going to be utterly important because I want you to know history. Again, it's important. The laws of the Medes and Persians, when they were written down, were absolutely binding. They could not be revoked. This is going to play very prominent when we get to the story of Esther. And that's going to be hugely important to remember that this law, when it's said and then written, is utterly binding. So it's going to play a prominent role. And notice what this pagan king says, as he's awake, it says, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. That's a pretty good statement from a pagan king. He doesn't sound so pagan after all, does he? And he, the Lord, the God of heaven, has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem. So, for me, there already was a house. Well, again, no, not any longer, because when Babylon came in and the southern kingdom fell in a series of waves, the temple was utterly destroyed. And all of the stuff in the temple was looted out and carried off to Babylon. But now, this pagan king is being stirred up to be used for the glory of God, for the sovereign plan of God. And notice he says, whoever, verse 3, is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He's the God who's in Jerusalem. In other words, this king is going to get to do something that David himself is not able to do. When we read earlier from 2 Samuel chapter 7, that came after David saying, you know what, God, I'm going to do you a big favor. He didn't say exactly those words. He says, you know, God, it's not right for me to live in this giant palace, and if you have this little fabric tent, tabernacle, how do you build you a house? To which God responds, David, first of all, not only you, but nobody can ever do anything like you. That's not a good word for us to hear. Starting GCDC, we're not doing God. He's the one who built the house. In fact, that's exactly what he says to David. He says this, David, not only are you not going to build a house, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to raise you to be a great household. He makes this amazing promise. Your kingdom is going to be everlasting through you. I'm going to set someone on the throne that is going to be established forever. Which is why we saw that prayer. God, may you do what you said, may you keep your word. But now, this pagan king, so many, probably 500 some years later, is building, being told, go build me this house in Judah, in the city of peace. And notice verse 4, and let each survivor or the remnant, in whatever place he sojourns, the blessed, let him be assisted by men of his place with silver and gold and with goods and with beasts, besides the free will offering of the house of God that's being used. In other words, you're going to build this house, and all the provisions for this house are going to be provided. Now, next week we'll pick up verse 5 and follow in, but in this wonderful beginning, what does it alert us to about the fact that God keeps his word? this rule of prevail. I think the first thing that the very least we can see is this, is that we can be sure, you can be sure, no matter where you are, no matter what you are in the middle of, whether it's calamity or success, whether it's medical distress or good health, whether it's ease or depression or whatever, whatever you're in the middle of, you need to understand this, God is moving for his glory. Don't ever think for a minute that he's ever stopped moving for his glory. He hasn't. In fact, through this, history is his story. And this is exactly where we step into the story. Because, see, actually, the author just assumed that you knew all the backstory to this, all of the build-up. But there's this amazing drama that God has been doing from the beginning of time with Adam and Eve, and it's going to stretch all the way to the end of Revelation when time as we know it comes to an end and we move into eternity. But God is doing this drama, and he's the main player on the stage. And he's doing something amazing. Because you remember the story, I think, at the beginning. God created this couple, this wonderful, delightful couple, Adam and Eve, and he placed them in the garden. But yet, the serpent came in and tempted them and deceived them in thinking that God's word wasn't enough, that they should probably rebel and be like, equal, or maybe even love God because God was probably trying to keep them down. And so they rebelled, and so from that point forward, we were separated from God. But then, through the story of this amazing problem, and it looked like anchors, totally on sight. God raised up this righteous guy by the name of Noah. Remember what he built? What did he build? The ark. This amazing thing of God's protection and presence that was making him safe. And of course, even the song for rain, he came down, floods came up. 40, I think that's the song. 40 days and 40 nights of rain. And God shuts the door of the ark and Noah and his family were spared and saved. God gives him this amazing promise. Never again in this way will I destroy the earth. He gave the rainbow as a sign. God gives promises. In fact, he's already given a promise to Adam and Eve that kind of jumped over. It's this, that your offspring is going to crush the head of the serpent in Genesis 3:15. There is going to come one who will end the curse so that wayward worshipers will be brought back to God. And that's this drama that God is doing. He's failing his glory. He's making promises. Then there comes this guy, son of an idol maker. The son of an idol maker, Abraham. And God comes to Abraham by his grace and says, Abraham, I'm choosing you and I'm calling you to leave this place and go to another place. To which when Abraham told his wife, she said, she didn't really say that. We don't know, but I imagine she did. To which God said, when you get there, I'll tell you to stop. Because you go on a trip like that, but when you raise, somebody said, something, yeah, okay. I don't want kids with me, especially my daughter. She wants to know everywhere they're going. And how long is it going to take? And can I bring my kid with me? But God gives Abraham this promise. And the promise is this, Abraham, I'm going to make your descendants more numerous than the sands of the sea, more than the stars, and through you, I'm going to bless the entire world. And of course, the crazy thing is that Abraham is of an age, and he was childless. He's not a parent. Are you going to pull this one off, God? But nonetheless, he makes this promise. And of course, the son of Rachel comes, Isaac, because they laughed at God. And surely not in my old age, Sarah. I am never going to have a child. I'm going to get that last person. She and he gave a child, and they named him Isaac. And of course, Isaac found his wife, and she had two wonderful baby boys. Remember their names? Esau was a little older, and Jacob, though we remember him the other way, Jacob and Esau, because Jacob reached out and grabbed the ankle of his brother. Esau was kind of a redhead, this is the thing. Jacob was kind of mama's boy, and Isaac of Esau, the son of Jacob, and yet Jacob ends up with the promise. Of course, later we know that changes Jacob's name to Israel. So he's gone from being a man of deceiving to the people of his promise. And of course, he has some wonderful boys who decide to kill one of their brothers. But God's doing something, right? Because had they not sold him into slavery, God's made a way for Joseph to get one of the brothers down to Egypt so that God's people would be saved through a terrible famine that was just ravishing the land. When he rose up to be the head of a leader of the house, and he sat in jail and wasted away, thinking he was forgotten, but the Bible tells us all along the way God was with Joseph. No wonder God keeps his promises, and he's got a plan to keep this drama unfolding for his Lord, for his offspring. Now, of course, they spent about 400 years in Egypt. They broke the promise to be enslaved, and then God raises up another guy and put into a little basket. Moses, right? Stuttering Moses, who surely could not be a spokesman for God, and yet Moses is this stuttering mouthpiece for this glorious king. And this is important because God uses unsuspecting people to accomplish his plans. The last person we think that God used is probably the first person that God would gloriously work for the glorious Lord. And so he raised up Moses, but of course after Moses came Joshua, and they wandered the wilderness because they loved God so much. They grumbled, they wanted to get back to Egypt, they rebelled, they were very much unfaithful, got hard-necked and stiff-necked with the picture. And so then God raised up in this really desperate time after Joshua, this period called the Judges. When everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes, and they were all doing whatever they pleased to themselves, and they would get all of the sin, they would get so terrible, they would cry out to God, he would raise up a judge who would come in and redeem them and release them, and finally they would worship God again, only to repeat the cycle over and over and over. There was a last judge that kind of overlapped from the period of judges into the prophets and kingdom. His name was Samuel. And Samuel came on the scene, and at this point, the people came to Samuel and they said, Samuel, we're done with this. We want to be like everybody else. We want a king. This is roughly about 900-ish something BC, getting close to 1000 BC. And they find this guy by the name of Saul, who was a pretty strapping guy, who was a prominent businessman, except he's a Benjaminite and not from the tribe of Judah, for whom the scepter is supposed to be. But yet they made him king, and of course Saul gets wayward and falls into sin, and he doesn't just want to be king, he wants to be priest, and he wants all privileges for himself, so God releases Saul and dispatches him, and he raises up this amazing king David, who we talked about earlier this morning. Great king, great administrator, great military man, but yet he's got this desire to build this house for God, and he says, no, it's not going to happen, for which he's replaced by his son, you remember him, Solomon. And Solomon is the one that Israel reaches its pinnacle for. He expands it, he conquers more, he gets more treasures. People are flocking to see him. He is so wise. They're giving money to do all this stuff. And it's out of that that God is able to build the temple to replace the tabernacle. But yet, with all of his wisdom, Solomon falls into sin too. Now you might say, what does this have to do with God moving in the Lord? Well, in all of his history, I don't want you to forget that God is still on his throne, and he's still moving, and he's still using all of these men and women. And though Solomon goes wayward and sins, God's pronouncement is this: Solomon, your kingdom is going to be ripped out of your hands, but not your hands, it's going to come out of your son's hands. Because I'm going to keep the people of my promise to faith. I'm going to stay true to my word. And so, of poor Solomon dies with lots of women and wives, which was his downfall. And two guys come up, a guy by the name of Jeroboam, who was the captain of Solomon's army, and Rehoboam from the south. And Rehoboam was the rightful heir to the throne, and yet people came to Rehoboam and said, "What about how you reign? How you rule?" Rehoboam consulted some people, some old men, some young men. I mean, the old men told him, "Listen, Rehoboam, if you will serve these people, they will serve you for the rest of your days." The young men gave him a different counsel. They said this: "Who do they think they are? You show them that your little peepee is harder than the thumb of your father, and you show them you're just going to rule and you're going to reign and you're the king." Now, which advice would you take? Well, Rehoboam dispatched the old and he took the young, and out of that, Jeroboam assembled a mighty body and said, "We will never serve you. We're going to split apart." And from that, the nation was divided into two segments. It was the north, and can you guess what the other one was? So good. North and south. North would never have anything religiously good about it. They would finally fall in 722 BC to the Assyrians. The Assyrians were very brutal and brutish in what they did. They would wipe you out, they would subject you, but they would also bring people in. They started to bring England, and the northern kingdom would never be the same. They would never be returned to any inkling of worshiping the one true God, which is why we get to the New Testament, and the Samaritans are utterly despised in the New Testament, because that's the area of the world. The south, on the other hand, had some marvelously good kings and some way more terrible kings, but finally, in a wave of succession, starting in 605 to 586 BC, in three different ways, they were reported and overtaken by Babylon. And then 7 years later is where we get to the point where we are in Ezra. What's going on is this, is that God is unveiling his glory in all of that. God is unveiling his glory in the highs and the lows of Israel, and he's showing himself to be supreme, and he's showing himself to be one who keeps his word and keeps his promises, regardless of what circumstances are saying around us. And what we can see is, don't get trapped into thinking for a moment that there's any on the right side of history. Not too long ago, I saw this little panel discussion on Hassan Gazer, who respect, E.A. Carson, John Piper, Tim Keller, they were on this, and they were talking about what should we say to people who would say things about this marriage thing that America has done. What do we say to people who look at us and say, "Listen, this is history. History is embracing LGBTQ+. You need to embrace it too. Otherwise, what you're going to find is, at the end of the day, some 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, people are going to look back at you today and they're going to say, you are on the wrong side of history if you don't go back." What would you say to somebody? I can't remember which one of the guys was. I think it might have been somehow. I don't remember who said this. He said, "What did I say is this? There's one person sovereignly ruling over all of history. And regardless if today or 70 years later it looks like Babylon, the Medes and Persians are in control, or Obama, or Bush, or Trump is in control, there's only one side of history that really matters, and that's the moment when the trumpet sounds and the skies open up and the King of Glory descends. And in that moment, I want to make sure that that's the moment where I'm on the right side of history. Because nothing else will matter. Because it will be like a blip compared to the eternity that he has reigned and will reign." See, no matter the times and moments of kings and what is happening for these sinful people, through whom God is moving and working, His glory and majesty will reign forever. Come. Come. But notice that's how He promises His plan. We've already talked a little bit about this. God stirs up the heart of this pagan king to accomplish His plans. You see, that God keeps His promises, we can be sure that He is still in the habit of stirring the hearts to accomplish His plans. See, He's sovereign, so His plan is ultimately changed. He's the only ultimate one. And anything else that we substitute for Him will become an idol. We'll talk more about that, because that's going to play so prominent throughout these books, that this trading the ultimate for other things that we may, even good things that we may hold things, but yet then they become idols. And so God is stirring up, and He's stirring up in ways that our logic would not probably have by now and risen on our own. But what's He doing? He's doing this in order to keep His promises. His promise to my David, I'm going to make your household great, and your kingdom is never going to come to an end, because one of your offspring is going to sit on the throne. Promises like to Abraham, I'm going to make you numerous. You're going to have more descendants than you can ever have. And through you, I'm going to bless the whole world through your offspring. And that's not through Isaac, by the way. Both of those find their completion ultimately in Jesus, the offspring who crushed the curse, crushed the head of the serpent, and made it possible for us to be reconciled with God and be found on the right side of history. But this is nothing new, that God can stir up the heart of a pagan king. In fact, under the first Chronicles 5:26, in verse 23, it says, the members of the half tribe of Manasseh, they lived in the land, they were numerous. From Seir all the way up to Mount Hermon, and the heads of their fathers, lots of strange names that you and I probably can't pronounce. Ishi, Eliel, Azrael, Jeremiah, Adaliah, Janiel. Just, you know, you're looking for a name for your next children. But notice what it says. But they broke faith with the God of their fathers and whored after the gods of the peoples of the land, whom God had destroyed before them. So the God of Israel did what? What does it say? Stir up, same word, stir up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he took them into exile, namely the Reubenites, the Gadites, the half tribe of Manasseh, and brought them to Hananel, Abraham, and the river of Hosea, even to this day. In other words, even though somebody might be a pagan, no affinity toward God, that doesn't mean they're not created and belong to God. What that means is exactly what Proverbs tells us. Proverbs 21, you can see. Truth is, a sovereign king who creates, rules, and reigns, and owns everything in the universe. And that includes us. Even though we're in the temple and we're created in His image, nonetheless, we would do well to remember we are still created. And notice what Proverbs 21:1 says. The king's heart is like water in the hands of the Lord. We do mix it. You know what that means? It means, I'm sorry, young people, but there's only one supreme ruler, and you're not it. And you, actually, in what you're doing even today, are being stirred up for some plan and purpose that we don't know today, but 10, 20, 30, 50, a million years from now, we'll see. It means that Putin, whether he did or didn't have an influence on the election, the truth is, kings come to go at the will of God. And so, whether he makes America great again, there is for all that, but somewhere 10, 20, 50, a million years from now, we'll be able to look back and see, oh, that's what you were doing, God, through Putin and Russia and America and all the different things that were happening. Your plan and your purposes will prevail. Your glory is going to live. That means the Saudi King Solomon and Queen Elizabeth or Theresa May or Trump or all of them and all of these elections that we go through, we think, wow, what have we done? The truth is, at the end of the day, the only one who is controlling history is not you and me, though we are to be obedient in the process, but ultimately it is God. Because he's sovereign, and he's the one who is ruling and reigning, and his plan will prevail. And you know he's doing the hell for his plan? He's stirring up the hearts of men and women. And we would do well to recognize that we're a part of this huge drama, but we're not the stars of the show. I've shared this before. Some of you have heard it, some of you haven't. But imagine this is kind of to illustrate the difference of being the star of the show and just supporting the cast. Sometime back when I was in college, I was a gymnast, and I was like, look at that, but I want to just be. And one of the summers between my second and third year of college, I was in an opera at Woodstock. You're good, right? Start singing, right? But I wasn't a singer. What I was is I was an acrobat on stage, and on was the rubber of three wonders. Yes. That was the title of the opera, a French opera. The rubber of three wonders. The rubber of the wonders. And I was a star. I was on stage for all of maybe a few minutes. I did a backflip on the stage and some other stuff. And I walked out and carried some props in the back. Now imagine if I came to you and said, hey, you want to take me to my opera? And you came, and then at the end, I met you and said, wasn't it great? Wasn't that great? Well, it was all about me. I mean, I was the star of the show. And you said, I didn't even see you. What would you think about me? Why did you bring me here? Or, wow, there's something wrong in your head. Because the truth is, everything that I did was only to amplify the drama and the story and draw all the attention back to the main character and characters and character. And the truth is the same with us. We're not the stars of the show. And we would do well to remember that Jesus is the star of this drama, and we're supporting the cast. And he's working to stir up the hearts of men and women and children so that people magnify and amplify the glory of this star. Who is the key to redemption? Who is the one who brought wayward worshipers back to God? Now, what does that mean? What do we do? Well, we trust this, thirdly, that he's already provided everything we need. Backstage this morning, if you have a wayward child, I would encourage you this. Pray that God will stir the heart of that child, or that we have a heart of loss, or that loved one. That would be stir the heart. That would you move in such a way that it would be amplified as a worshiper for your glory and not someone in opposition to you. And trust this. truth is, God has already planted everything that we need to be successful in this world. This is the problem. I'm going to talk more about that next week and how God goes about building. But notice here at this point, he tells them, notice back to verse 4 of your reservoir. King Cyrus says, look, here's how you're going to build this temple. Let each of you survivors, whatever place you sojourn, let you be assisted by the men of that place with silver and gold and goods and beasts, and besides the free will offered for the house of God that's in Jerusalem. In other words, as you go, you go back to the land where people have made their homes for 7 years, and they're going to help you out. They don't know yet what they're going to do. You know why? Because I'm the king of Persia, I declare. In other words, everything that you're going to need to build the house is already provided for you. Go get it. Go build it. Now, what does all this mean for us? It means this. Let's not ever take a position of despair as God's people, but let's hope that God can still stir our hearts today. Let's pray that we would, let's see him, let's ask that he would stir the heart of bosses and husbands and wives and neighbors and world leaders so that we can rest knowing that his plan and his purposes will prevail and trust that he's doing something amazing on the scene of our world. That's my sin. And let's not get trapped into thinking that he's doing something other than something amazing for his glory and his work. That is a little verse, 1 Peter chapter 5, you probably know it. If you're ever anxious, you probably have said this, cast all your cares on him. Why? Because he cares for you. But I would encourage you, if you're going to look at that verse in the context, the command there really isn't cast all your cares. The command is back in the previous verse, and the command is this: submit yourselves under the mighty hand of God, casting all of your cares upon him. See, the way you show that you're submitted under the mighty hand of the sovereign God, who's ruling and reigning and working for his glory always, is by casting all your cares on him, knowing that he cares for you, because his glory is amazing. But even that's not history, positioning you appropriately. So let's rest in the fact that he keeps his promises and submit himself by asking that his God be struggling with him. But would you stir the heart of God? There's got to be one thing that's going to happen. Next, let me encourage you to realize that God has still provided all that we need. We're going to get a little more of this next week, and I'm going to show you some amazing connections between First Exodus, this, the second Exodus, and then the amazing building project that God is doing today, and similarities. But let's still be reminded that God has provided everything that we need. He's provided a proof of Jesus, the treasure of this universe. And then finally, let's be reminded this morning that we will be utterly frustrated and disappointed unless we realize that our lives are not for your story from this world. My life world is not it. Our life at GCDC is not it. We're here for a much bigger room. We're here for the glory of the King. And while we want God to stir the hearts of all those other people out there, let's not forget how would you stir them up. That's stirring them sensitive, to be cognizant, and understand what you're doing around me, so that I can be positioned for your glory. In fact, let's maybe, like David Livingston prayed, walks 29,000 miles away, half blind, half. His wife dead, doesn't burn this out. His people at home were trying to stop him and shut him down. And yet, this was his prayer. God, send me anywhere, only go God laid any burden on me, only sustained me. God severed me from any tie but the tie that binds me to your service and to your heart. Knowing fully that the only tie that binds us to God is grace through the Spirit. Let's stand on that. Because God does keep his promises. And we know that because he sent his Son to live and die in our place and to rise again and crush the head of death and sin so that we could be rescued. And written in the annals, illustrating a little work from the Lamb's Book of Life. So that